This is a podcast from meow.net.
Meow!
Meanwhile, in an abandoned warehouse.
Welcome to Meanwhile in an Abandoned Warehouse. My name's Owen Kelly, and today I want to conclude the conversation that Sophie Hope and I had last month, although this month, unfortunately, Sophie can't be with us. Now, let me start by saying that Arlene, Francoise, Sophie and I all live and work in different places, on different continents, in different countries, and so we have an internal message board that we use to communicate. After last month's episode, Arlene left a message for Sophie and I, which I'll now, with her permission, read to you. She wrote that she felt we were, and I quote, a bit misleading in part, and I want to mention it in case you agree and want to correct it in future. Copyright per se has nothing to do with revenue. It's about the right to reproduce and make use of something. So if I put the copyright symbol and date on one of my paintings, and then I see someone has reproduced that painting, I can sue that person for damages and force the person to cease and desist. I can make the argument that I'm entitled to all the money that person has made on my painting. But even if whoever reproduced it was a non-profit organisation using it for a non-commercial purpose, I could still sue for violation of copyright. Royalties are another question. Some nations have relevant regulations such as resale royalties. If in one of those countries I sell you one of my paintings and later you resell it for more money, under such regulations, you owe me a percentage of the profit. But aside from that, there's no provision that links copyright to specific payment or identifies a specific royalty arrangement. That's generally covered by a contract, either an individual one you might have with a publisher or a general one that your union might have to cover all members, or by entering into an agreement with some royalty agents, such as BMI, for music. From the way you were talking about it, I think a listener would get the impression that copyrighting a work entitles the holder to royalties. But that isn't true. It may entitle the holder to damages in a lawsuit, but without a contract specifying royalties, that's it. Now, I want to say here that Arlene's completely correct. I think in trying to simplify a complex argument, Sophie and I oversimplified to the point of implying something we didn't actually mean. So let me get this straight by going right back to the basics and reading out a definition of copyright from the US Copyright Office. They say, copyright is a type of intellectual property that protects original works of authorship as soon as an author fixes the work in a tangible form of expression. In copyright law, there are lots of different types of works, including paintings, photographs, illustrations, music compositions, sound recordings, computer programs, books, poems, blog posts, movies, architectural works, plays, and so much more. Copyright is a mixture of originality and fixation. Works are original when they are independently created by a human author and have a minimal degree of creativity. Independent creation simply means you've created it yourself without copying. The Supreme Court has said that to be creative, a work must have a spark and modicum of creativity. There are some things, however, that are not creative, like titles, names, short phrases and slogans, familiar symbols or designs, mere variations of typographical ornamentation, lettering or colouring, a mere listing of ingredients or contents. And always keep in mind that copyright protects expression and never ideas, procedures, methods, systems, processes, concepts, principles or discoveries. In terms of fixed works, a work is deemed fixed when it is captured, either by or under the authority of an author, in a sufficiently permanent medium such that the work can be perceived, reproduced or communicated for more than a short time. For example, a work is fixed when you write it down or record it. A website, Investopedia, adds to that. Investopedia says, not all types of works can be copyrighted. A copyright does not protect ideas, discoveries, concepts, or theories. Brand names, logos, slogans, domain names, and titles cannot be copyrighted under copyright law. For an original work to be copyrighted, it has to be in tangible form. We heard that. This means that any speech, discoveries, musical scores, or ideas have to be written down in physical form in order to be protected by copyright. In the US, copyright owners are protected by copyright law all their lives until 70 years after their death. If the original author of the copyrighted material is a corporation, then as we said last month, the copyright protection is 95 years from the date of publication, or 120 years, whichever expires first. That's the made-for-hire provision we talked about last time. US copyright law has experienced a number of amendments and changes that have altered the duration of copyright protection. The life of the author plus 70 years protection can be attributed to the 1998 Copyright Term Extension Act, also known as the Mickey Mouse Protection Act or Sonny Bono Act, which generally increased copyright protection by 20 years. Now, Arlene hit upon something very important when she mentioned BMI as a royalty collecting agency. Something I think I failed to make clear in the previous episode. As she points out, if she creates a painting, then she owns the copyright on that painting, whether she registers that fact or not. In this case, there's a simple relationship. One painting, one copyright owner. Copyright comes into play as soon as the painting is finished and is there as a work of art that is fixed. However, in more collaborative practices, there may be several layers of copyright coexisting. Let's look at an example. In 1956, Chuck Berry wrote Roll Over Beethoven. He couldn't claim any copyright over it until he recorded it or wrote it out as sheet music. If he'd simply played it live for 50 years, then he'd have no claim on it. He solved this problem by placing this and his other songs with a music publisher. And he then, as Arlene suggested, signed a contract that may or may not later have seemed fair or just. The job of the publisher was to get the work out into the public and collect royalties every time the music was played, and to pay Chuck Berry an agreed percentage of this royalty. Chuck Berry then recorded the song, had a major hit, had other people cover it, and collected money every time a record was sold, another band played the song live, or a radio station played a record of that song, whether by him or somebody else. The recording he made was also subject to a separate copyright. So, when ELO, the Electric Light Orchestra, recorded their elaborate cover version that actually quoted Beethoven at some length, Chuck Berry would receive songwriting royalties, but no royalties from the recording itself. These would go to Jeff Lynne, who'd signed a separate recording contract and a separate publishing contract. The arrangement, incorporating the opening to Beethoven's Fifth, as well as other melodies from the symphony, might itself be the subject of a separate copyright arrangement. This layering process applies in most modern media, but complicates, not invalidates, what Arlene pointed out. However, importantly, as we said earlier, not everything can be copyrighted. So things that can't be copyrighted include works that aren't fixed in any tangible form. Chuck Berry playing Roll Over Beethoven live, a speech that isn't recorded or written out, that sort of thing. Titles, names, short phrases and slogans, including book titles and song titles. Familiar symbols or designs. Ideas, procedures, methods, systems, processes, concepts, principles, discoveries or devices. And works, importantly, that are common property or are in the public domain, like historical facts or measurement conversions. Now we'll come back to the idea of common property in the public domain later. For the moment, I'll just say that the Balancing Money website defines the public domain as a term that means works that have no restrictions on their use. Works can be in the public domain if the copyright has expired, the owner has taken the work out of copyright, or copyright law doesn't protect it. Now, in Meanwhile in an Abandoned Warehouse, Sophie and I try to relate our arguments to something topical. and ask what that shows us about culture and democracy. In this episode, I want to move on to look at the relationship between copyright and trademarking and relate this to two events that have happened in the last month. Investopedia defines the difference between the two like this. It says, a copyright protects a creator's original work from being used or duplicated without their permission. A trademark protects the reputation of a business that is associated with identifying materials such as their logo or slogan. Both are ways of protecting intellectual property. Balancing Money adds, a trademark is a word, name, symbol or device or any combination which is used or intended to be used to identify and distinguish the goods or products of one company from those of another. For example, your company name may be able to be trademarked along with your logo or the artwork that goes along with your company name. Let me now quote from a website called NerdWallet. Another apparently indispensable source of information for this kind of thing. NerdWallet says, in short, a trademark can apply to anything that essentially brands a business or identifies a company or product. Here are some well-known examples. The Tabasco sauce bottle with the hexagonal screw top is trademarked. Foot long, written as all one word, is trademarked by Subway Sandwiches. The McDonald's golden arch symbol is trademarked. This being said, when it comes to trademarks, it's important to distinguish between a trademark and a service mark. Although the term trademark is typically used to encompass both, a service mark is specifically used to distinguish the services of one business from those provided by another. An example of a service mark is the United Airlines slogan, "Fly the Friendly Skies." Although the United Airlines name itself might be trademarked, the slogan which defines the service they provide is service marked. All this being said, another important difference between copyright and trademark is that whereas copyrights expire after a set period, trademarks never expire. So overall, trademark rights come from actual use. In other words, using your mark in the course of doing business. And therefore your trademark can last forever as long as you continue to use it. The purpose of a trademark differs from the purpose of copyright. Copyright was originally intended as a means of enabling a creator, often but not always an artist, to earn a living by protecting them from copycats for a fixed period of time. Trademarks, on the other hand, are designed to protect customers from being misled. Even if your name is Matthew, you cannot start a burger chain and use a big yellow M as your sign. McDonald's will say that you are trying to deliberately confuse their customers. And they'll probably say the same thing if you try to call your burger a Big Mat, even if you don't use a big yellow sign. Okay, so far so good. We have two ways of protecting intellectual property, and whatever we think about roadside burgers or rock and roll, they serve to do a job. Problems occur, though, widespread societal problems occur, when large corporations seek to extend the reach of these concepts and then to merge them. Let's take an example of a long-standing trademark in use. Snap, Crackle and Pop, the three little elves with hats, are trademarks that Kellogg's has used for years on Rice Krispies across the world. Tony the Tiger is similarly a trademark that they've used on Frosties or Frosted Flakes, depending where you live. 50 years ago, before people worried about sugar intake and obesity, these cartoon characters used to appear on television advertisements and in adverts in comics. And almost all children, whether they actually ate Rice Krispies or Frosted Flakes, knew about them, could name them. Their job, for better or worse, was to personify the brands, to make them into something cuddly that children would want. However, other than in the free gifts that appeared in the packets, they did not appear anywhere else. They were trademarks of Frosties and Rice Krispies, and that's where they appeared, or on advertisements for them. They were distinct from the copyrighted characters who appeared in comics or in movies. Superman was a copyrighted character in comics. Mickey Mouse was a copyrighted character in cartoons, movies. Then the Disney Corporation trademarked Mickey Mouse, claiming that it now meant Disney in its customers' minds. That when customers thought of Disney, they necessarily thought of Mickey Mouse, and when customers thought of Mickey Mouse, they necessarily thought of Disney. The result of that is that as a trademark, Mickey Mouse will never expire. When the copyright on the Sherlock Holmes stories expired, other authors became free to write new stories. When the copyright on Mickey Mouse finally expires, other creators will still find it almost impossible to create new stories without first passing them in front of Disney's lawyers for them to judge whether or not, in their opinion, the new stories dilute or damage Disney's brand. This constitutes an important and so far successful attempt to muddy the copyright waters. As copyrighted characters, Mickey Mouse and his companions will enter the public domain sometime soon. As trademarks, they will never leave Disney's control, which in turn serves to diminish the intentions of the copyright laws. A second use of trademarks has occurred in the last few decades, and I'll talk about two examples of this in a minute. First, I want to quote from an article in Tech Dirt in 2009, where Mike Masnick wrote the following. He wrote, "Over the years, we've seen a ton of lawsuits against so-called gripes sites, people who set up a website because they feel wronged by a company. Company lawyers will either try and bully such sites and claim they're a trademark violation, especially when they use a name like bigcompanysucks.com. The big companies almost always lose such lawsuits. That's because those sites are obviously not from the company itself and don't cause any sort of consumer confusion over who runs the sites. Earlier this year, that's in 2009, we heard that lawyers were finally starting to recognise that suing gripes sites was not a good idea. First, you'd almost certainly lose, but more importantly, you'd end up drawing a lot more attention to the gripe site. However, it looks like there are a bunch of folks that haven't got the message. Soon after that article, we saw Goldman Sachs go after a gripe site, and the same story played out again. A lot more attention to the gripe site, and the all-powerful Goldman Sachs eventually had to back down. And yet it keeps appearing. The latest such story takes place up in Canada, and rather than a traditional disgruntled customer or ex-employee, the gripe site in question is from a union. Michael Scott pointed us to the news that Walmart is trying to shut down a union website using quite a creative interpretation of trademark law to suggest it blocks out all sorts of stuff it does not like. They want to order the court to order the union to refrain from using the names Walmart as a trademark alone or with other indicia or in any sense of format, not to use the expression Walmart Workers Canada or Union for Walmart Workers in any formal format, not to use the expression get respect, live better, or any other expression which constitutes wordplay on Walmart's trademark slogan, save money, live better, not to use photos or images of Walmart employees or people purporting to be such employees, not to use an oval, circular or semicircular design similar to the design that includes spokes and figures in association with the trademark Walmart, and to take down the website www.walmartworkerscanada.ca. Now, I quote from that to set the scene that something happened this month, in October 2023. It seems there that what Walmart were trying to do, and incidentally they lost, of course, what they were trying to do is simply argue that any use of the word Walmart was the right to prevent, rather than what the trademark mark laws said, that they need to be able to prevent the other companies from masquerading as them. Now, let me quote this time from Tech Dirt again, from an article that Timothy Gegner wrote in October 2023. He said, "One of the things we've noticed more frequently of late has been larger companies attempting to use trademark law as some kind of cudgel against employee unions. This has taken several forms, from Walmart, which we've just heard about, trying to shut down a union website for accurately calling itself a union of Walmart employees, Medieval Times trying to shutter a website and its merchandise for its performers' union for the same reason, and Trader Joe's attacking its employers' union ostensibly for similar reasons, but really just because it wanted to cause as much trouble and pain for the union as possible. Now, this case is admittedly different and arguably worse. In this case, Starbucks has threatened Starbucks Workers' Union with a trademark lawsuit, principally, it appears, because the union started tweeting things the company doesn't like about Gaza. Starbucks is threatening to sue Starbucks Workers United, the union that represents employees of the coffee conglomerate, for trademark infringing, following the union's Solidarity with Palestine tweet. Last week, a letter was sent to the president of the union demanding that the union immediately cease and desist from using the company's name and logo, or the company will pursue legal action, including, without limitation, monetary damages. Now, the union has now deleted the tweet, but it read Solidarity with Palestine and was sent out in the midst of Israel's response to a horrific terror attack launched by Hamas out of the Gaza Strip. Now, TechDirt says, there's a lot to discuss about the history leading up to this conflict, actions that have been taken on both sides of the equation here, and all the rest. But this is not the forum for that discussion. Nor is the union's opinion on matter of geopolitics in any way trespassing into the realm of trademark law. In other words, the union's activities don't suddenly become trademark infringements simply because they tweeted out something that Starbucks doesn't like, even if you, and even if I, and even if all of our listeners, and even if all of our Starbucks customers don't like it either. It appears the lawyers from Starbucks either don't understand that, or are hoping that the lawyers for the union don't understand that. So we can see here that trademarks are being misused as weapons against people and groups who have a perfect right to use the term for whatever reasons. However, even more egregious is the final case I want to bring to your attention today. This one involves the so-called Easy Group, who last month threatened legal action against the Leicester-based indie band Easy Life for trademark infringement. According to The Guardian, in a statement, a spokesman for the company said the band were engaged in the deliberate misleading of the consumer to think they're part of the Easy family in order to increase their own sales. Mr. Matravers, the singer of the band, has intentionally used Easy Group's well-known stylization and images of EasyJet planes in his marketing. Easy Group stated that they were seeking substantial financial damages. Now, it might be deemed unwise of the band to use parodies of EasyJet's livery in their advertising, but that does not say anything about their right to name themselves Easy Life. Easy Group has a long history of launching legal actions of this kind, with a section of its website that brazenly documents its efforts to protect its brand from what it calls thieves. These include an attempt in 2018 to block Netflix from titling one of its series Easy. Now, that one obviously didn't succeed, because there they'd chosen to go up against a company that probably has more assets than they do, and the company simply issued a sarcastic response, and the lawsuit melted away. Now, how did Easy Group acquire the brand name Easy Life, which they do in fact own? Did they create it for a company that they were forming? No, they didn't. In July 2022, they got the name from a company who'd been trading since 1992 with a catalogue retail business that later also moved online. An Easy Group have now stated that Easy Life pay them annual royalties for use of the Easy Life brand name. The previous year, 2021, Easy Group had taken Easy Life to court, arguing the company infringed on their own trademark. A judge ruled against Easy Group in July 2021, saying In my judgment, the word easy is not distinctive. It's a descriptive word. A substantial number of the public will not be induced to buy goods from Easy Life by mistaking the insignia of Easy Group. The judge also ordered two brand names from the sprawling Easy Group family, Easy Land and Easy for Men, to be revoked for non-use. However, somehow a few months later, for reasons we will never know, this long-standing company decided to sell the brand name to the Easy Group and then pay the Easy Group royalties to continue to use it. On their own website, the band Easy Life, who formed in 2015 and have built a substantial reputation since then, wrote, "We are not a nameless company. As you've seen, it's our own personal names on the paperwork. This means that should we lose, the costs will be recouped from us personally. They could take everything, material possessions, our livelihoods, our homes. You can imagine the turmoil this has caused us, but I really hope that this helps you understand our situation. We found solace in the outpourings of love and support, for which we are all grateful for beyond words. I'm writing this on Tuesday, now in the knowledge that our final day as the Easy Life you know is probably Friday, fittingly Friday the 13th. We've managed to get some shows together, literally booked last night, and we really hope as many of you as possible will be able to come and join us for the farewell parties." So, they're going to be forced to change their name, just when apparently they were on the verge of releasing what number of people had said would be their breakout single. All of this points towards something that has direct relevance to our concerns on these podcasts. Copyright laws, often posited as the unfair capitalist tool to be opposed in favour of copyleft or Creative Commons, licensing arrangements that people claim are inherently fairer and more democratic. However, in reality, these form two axes of a trinity, because both of these have another sibling, the public domain, which forms the ultimate cultural soil from which every creative artifact ultimately grows. Jeff Lynne could quote Beethoven in his version of Roll Over Beethoven, because Beethoven's music entered the public domain long ago. When Richard Thompson wrote Roll Over Vaughan Williams, an attempt to write a rock and roll song that had no influences from America whatsoever, he could not quote freely from Williams without seeking all sorts of permissions and licenses, even though Williams had died 15 years before the song was written. The length of copyright has been extended not to benefit creators, who stop benefiting anyway as soon as they die, but to benefit corporations. The mingling of copyright and trademarking has also been entirely to the benefit of corporations, who wish to privatise the cultural environment in which we live and from which we draw our ideas and inspirations. The attempt by the so-called Easy Group to engage in preemptive trademarking again narrows down the space in which we can move culturally. The judge who pointed out that easy is a common descriptive word, not capable of being registered as distinctive, had it right, and this should be recognised and enforced. The consequence of not enforcing it is that Easy Group are in a position where they can claim that any name that has the word easy as part of it belongs to them. The Easy Chair Company. Oh, that must be us. That is simply not permissible. That serves to limit the space within which ideas can grow. This is an ongoing process with important cultural and political outcomes and economic outcomes. In 1995, for example, the United States Supreme Court finally held that a colour can be registered as a trademark upon presentation of evidence showing that the colour has become associated with a particular product and can be identified as a particular source for that product. The perception of colour in reality is subjective and varies from person to person. This pronouncement merely creates opportunities for mischief makers and copyright trolls, trademark trolls, and job opportunities for lawyers. The public domain needs defending, just as initiatives like Creative Commons need supporting, and attempts to move the goalposts with regard to both copyright and trademarking need opposing. Otherwise, we'll rapidly end up watching our collective space and our means of expression within that space getting smaller and smaller. Next month, hopefully, Sophie will be back, and we'll be delving into the impossible arts infrastructure. That's all for now. Thank you for listening. Now that you've heard the podcast, please go to the website. There you'll find much more details about topics talked about, links to references, and much more. You can find the website at miaw.net. That's miaw.net. See you there.